Comments made on the Serotalk Podcast Network are those of the individuals and do not represent Serotalk Corporation, its staff, management, board of directors, or third-party resellers.
Welcome to the Serotalk Podcast.
Welcome to the Serotalk Podcast, your portal to the accessible digital lifestyle. www.serotalk.com, a production of Serotech Corporation, makers of System Access, the System Access Mobile Network, and SA2Go. Learn about new technology, cool software, useful websites, education, information, entertainment, user comments, and much more. And now, here's your host, Michael Loff.
Welcome to Zero Talk Podcast 77 for September 20, 2011. This is Michael Loff.
I'm Ricky Inger.
I'm Justin Kim.
Oh, it feels like we just did this.
Switched to the weekly format, we have to wonder, wow, will there always be exciting and cool stuff happening every week?
No,
you know,
this week
not really anything going on. Nobody did anything. Nothing to talk about.
Slow week. Yeah.
Yep.
No, nothing major that I can think of. Or wait a minute.
Isn't there some kind of weird thing in Seattle about coffee or
Anaheim, where the mouse lives?
Anaheim, California.
Yeah. Something about an operating system.
Some folks are excited and some went to sleep. Yes, Microsoft showed their preview. Not even beta, folks. Not even alpha. This is preview. Windows 8 was announced on Tuesday at the Build Conference in Anaheim, California. And, God, what do you want to say? It's a preview, so only true geeks should probably be playing around with this bad boy. What do we say about it? First of all, I would say if you're going to play around with it, it would be wise to have a dedicated machine or maybe some eyeballs to help you upgrade if you're using a virtual machine. Although I told Dal, I guess you can, if you have a virtual machine, you can upgrade Windows 7 up to Windows 8 through doing that.
Yeah, you don't want to be putting this on your production machine. Again, this is not a beta. This is not even an alpha. So what you're getting is by no means promised to be stable and bug-free. There's a lot of information out there. First of all, you can watch the Windows 8 keynotes from the Build website.
And there are lots, and I mean lots, of sessions on the Build website. There are, last time I checked, more than 20 pages of different videos from Microsoft and Channel 9 up there. So if you're really interested and you really want to know a lot about Windows, that is the place to go, www.buildwindows.com.
Yep. And one thing that struck me during these various sessions is that keyboard navigation was actually mentioned fairly frequently. And yes, they did talk about how Windows 8 is going to have touch and it's going to be great for tablets. But again, keyboard shortcuts were mentioned pretty frequently. And there is a list of Windows 8 shortcuts available over at the show notes, along with a lot of different articles from different tech sites taking a look at Windows 8 and sort of giving their opinions on things.
Steven Sinofsky, one of the masterminds behind Windows, actually made a point to say several times that he is a keyboard user and he wanted to make sure that there were keyboard navigation throughout all of Windows.
So you can read a lot more about that over at serotalk.com because we have 13 different links talking about everything from fast boot ups on newer computers under 10 seconds, and that you can actually go get the link to where to go get the new .iso images, how to install a USB key if you need to, and that it's even scalable to run on the old Atom processors with 1 gig of RAM, like netbooks and stuff like that. So,
yes.
And again, as Ricky mentioned, the Windows 8 keyboard shortcuts and some mentions of accessibility and some gesture controls and side-by-side app viewing. So all that you can read about. But again, you know, if you're going to play with it, have some dedicated hardware for that purpose. And if it quits talking to you, don't ask for help. At least not from a screen reader manufacturer, because, you know, everyone's playing around with it and the operating system will change between now and its official release. But if you're brave and daring, go for it.
And if you are going to install Windows 8 on a machine that you actually care about, you will perhaps want to clone what's on that drive at the moment. And we have an article talking about the best cloning software for Windows. And the one that these guys like the most is Drive Image XML. Have you played with this before?
Yes, I just played with it recently, and I was excited about the fact that A, it was free, and B, it appeared to actually work. The problem with all these drive imaging programs is they're not really accessible, or at least fully accessible. And I was always a big fan of Acronis, and they just came out in 2012, not usable with any screen reader under Windows. Unfortunate, because it is a good program, or was a good program, but if we can't use it, I guess not. But so Drive XML is certainly something to play around with, although you never know with these programs until you actually restore the image. That's when you find out really what it's made of. But they highly recommended it, and it did work. So.
Oh, it did. And how was the accessibility? I know that they do sort of warn you that, yes, this is functional, but not necessarily user-friendly.
Yeah, it does require some mouse navigation. So you want to know the mouse commands for your screen reading technology once you click on the source and destination drives. And, you know, it is simple as they said, but actually, from my perspective, what else do I want? I don't need 100 different features. I just want to make an image of a good drive and put it somewhere else on another drive and be able to restore it if I need it. So Control B starts the backup process. So give that a play if you value having good backup software. But also in Windows 8, they talked about gestures. Logitech has come out with a wireless touchpad that you can use to pinch, point, and scroll, and even talks about gestures already built into Windows 7. But you get 5 inches of surface to play around with, and they say they kind of liken it to the Magic Trackpad or Tragic Mat.
Yeah, I was going to say, is it about the size of a Tragic Mac pad?
Yes, it is, actually. About 5 inches to work with, and... you got multi-touch gestures, like 1 finger to move the cursor, 2 fingers page scroll, 3 finger photos, and 4 fingers for browsing their various applications and switching between them. So 2 buttons, of course, act as left and right mouse, and of course you can press down on it to emulate clicking. So again, a lot like the Mac Pad, I guess. So you can give a play with that. When it's out, it's not out yet. It's about $50 is going to be the cost on that. And it comes with a module that you plug in that can navigate up to 5 different Logitech devices, freeing up your USB port. So we can ultimately say some point down the road that gestures that we now enjoy on our iOS devices will come to Windows. I'll be curious to see how accessible they are and how we interact with those gestures.
Lifehacker has a really good article about the crappiest Windows programs that everybody uses and some alternatives that you can look at instead of using these programs. Adobe Acrobat Reader is on the top of the list, and they recommend a few alternatives that don't have that annoying startup manager or whatever you call it, don't take up so much memory, and tend to load a lot faster. And just a quick bit of self-promotion, DocuScan Plus will also handle PDFs quite nicely. They cover things like antivirus and suggest not using commercial and bloated pieces of software like Norton and McAfee. They actually really like Microsoft Essentials. And what's not to like? It's free, and it actually seems to do a decent job without being too resource intensive. This covers several other things, so if you want to take a look at it, head on over to the show notes.
Yeah, that's a tough one because, you know, I saw a computer just get hosed the other day by using Microsoft Security Essentials, so there are certain limitations.
Yeah,
so,
I suppose that's true with any antivirus. I don't think that any program can always catch everything. But you want to have something that's good enough to catch 99.9% of whatever it is that you're doing. What do you use? I use Viper, which is a paid program from Sunbelt Software, very accessible and lightweight.
Well, I was using Viper. My license expired, and I now went back to, I'm playing around with Nod32. I was told by a local technician here that Nod32 is used, it's from ESET, used by the government, which I don't know, still don't know if that's true or just him trying to sell it, but I'm running a 30-day demo, and of course they came out with version 5, which I have some real concerns about accessibility. I mean, I hear it prompt me for things, but navigating to them, to address them, is a concern right now. So if you were playing around with that, or 4 was accessible because I went right from 3 to 5. So 4 is usable and you're finding 5 is not, or you found some accessibility tips and tricks, let us know at resources@serialtalk.com. Just came out the other day.
Well, hey, I think we've talked enough about Windows, don't you? Let's talk about something else. Let's talk about Ubuntu. They have released version 11.10, and it has definitely a new look, and they've added Thunderbird, so you no longer necessarily have to use Evolution. Thunderbird is an official part of the distro now. There are a couple of articles talking about what we can look forward to as far as what's coming to the Ubuntu desktop. And apparently, they sort of want to take a page from Firefox's book and do a monthly release cycle. At least that's what one Ubuntu technical board member has suggested. And the idea is that they've got a 6-month release cycle right now. And what tends to happen is that they want to get these new features pushed out, and some of them are ready and some of them are half-baked and not quite ready for prime time, but the release schedule demanded that certain features be released during this 6-month cycle. And his idea is that doing a 1-month release cycle will allow them to make some incremental changes that make a bit more sense and are a little more comfortable for the user.
Yeah, that makes it tough because how many people want to install a new OS every month? So I'm more in the less is more category, or update it in such a way, just to say we do with the System Access Screen Reader, where you can do incremental updates and build it into the technology so that they can just update the necessary components without people having to reinstall a whole new operating system.
Right. Well, I don't think they would need to do that. I think they can do an upgrade of the version and still keep the data intact. But I haven't looked at Ubuntu in quite some time, so I couldn't really tell you what it looks like, especially after they have made the switch from the GNOME desktop to Unity. But if anybody has any thoughts on that, definitely send us some feedback at resources@serialtalk.com. We want to know what's going on in Ubuntu land from a user's perspective.
And if computer operating systems do you like Lay's potato chips and no one can have just one, you can certainly now have something to work with Lion for the Mac and maybe even Windows 8, because it looks like VMware has released version 4.0 for the Mac. And I guess the Windows, I guess they're still calling it Workstation, version 8.0. And the version for the Mac and Lion is $49 through the end of the year. Then I think it'll go up to $79. But with accelerated graphics and surround sound capabilities, and then version 8 for Windows is $99 if you're upgrading to version 6 or 7. They've, I guess, got you by stranglehold if you're using it in Windows, and more of a corporate thing, maybe, whereas the Mac hasn't made that corporate integration yet. But it's $199 if you buy it outright. But my big red flag here for me, Ricky, and I haven't played with it yet, so I'd like to hear from anyone who has, is a new, improved, easier-to-use user interface. Usually when I hear that, it could be possibly a step backward in accessibility.
Kind of say, uh-oh. I noticed some steps backward even going from Workstation 6 to 7, and I haven't looked at 8 on the Windows platform yet, nor have I upgraded my version of Fusion on the Mac, but I will probably do one at least, maybe not both. If anybody has any feedback and they've tried either VMware 8 or VMware Fusion 4, let us know.
Well, coming soon, it's Twitter spam. You will soon see tweets from folks that you don't necessarily follow. Brands and advertisers can now reach users with similar interests based on your current followers. And this is determined by kind of looking at the types of things that we tweet, who we follow, who we interact with, and what we respond to. So I don't know. My concern with this, I understand it's a way for them to monetize Twitter. That's always been the question. How are they going to make money with the service? But my concern is, what does it do to our credibility if end users, people who follow us, cannot delineate the difference between what we tweet and third-party advertising that's thrown in, mixed in with what we do?
Well, I think the way that it works is that it will appear in a user's timeline. So even if you don't follow somebody, they'll see this sponsored tweet from, say, JetBlue or whomever, And my concern is, as a user, I mean, yes, you can ignore things like this. You can ignore these advertisements, just skip right past them. But there is supposedly a way that you can dismiss a company's ads from your timeline, but you have to do that from a site. I don't know how clients are going to handle this. And of course, I know very few people who use Twitter directly from the site itself. People are usually doing this stuff from clients. So I'm wondering how clients are going to manage being able to dismiss these ads or whatever.
On that note, it's time for
Fun with Phones.
And if you like the quality of AT&T network but really don't want to pay the prices, H2O Wireless now offers unlimited everything for just $60 per month. That's would be $89.99, I guess, or really $100 with all the taxes if you paid it through AT&T. But I do have to wonder if it is truly unlimited data usage. I mean, if AT&T is capping their own customers, why would a third party like H2O receive unlimited? But actually, a lot of folks don't know. There's a lot of third-party options like that. I mean, the same, you know, Verizon has third-party entities. Sprint has third-party entities that you can get things for $60, maybe even $50 a month. So it's worth it to shop around. It's a great podcast if you want to really geek out on cell phone stuff called The Cell Phone Junkie, TCPJ. We have a link for that on Samnet, or I think it's cellphonejunkie.com, and you can learn all you'd ever want to know and then some about cell mobile phone services and different data plans and so forth. But Verizon and AT&T also is introducing a new prepaid plans, but these only work with certain phones, of course. Verizon now has set up a $50 per month plan with prepaid for selected phones, and again, like we talked about, competition, it's a good thing. This is spurred from competition from Virgin Mobile and Boost and Metro PCS. And Metro PCS has plans for $40 per month. And customers apparently who use Boost and pay their bills on time can go down as low as $35 per month. I've heard Boost is not necessarily that reliable, but the point here is that there are options and you can save lots of money. Of course, Verizon, the handsets will first include only 4 units from LG, Samsung, and Pantech. And of course, some of these prepaid phones will also work with the plan. So you just have to shop around or call, but basically you have to, you know, they're not going to offer it up as their first option on the menu. Say, well, here, yeah, why don't I save you money?
That's not going to happen.
You know, you've got to be aggressive and say, I want prepaid. I don't want a 2-year commitment.
And you got to watch out with some of these phones because they're Android-based, and some of the Androids are still 2.1s out there. So there's some accessibility differences between Android 2.1, 2.2, and 2.3. So if you're looking for an Android phone because it has built-in screen reader support with Spiel or TalkBack or any of the number of Android options, you still have to be watching out for what version of Android is running on that particular phone. And that would be one of the things I would suggest you look into with each phone when you go to buy one of these great phones that are available.
Yeah, and you would say, right, nothing before 2.2, right? 2.2 or later?
Yeah, 2.2 is where we're seeing a kind of the cutoff these days. It certainly started at Google I.O. where Google said 2.2 and higher is what they're looking to support. So they also said that they would support phones with updates to Android 18 months after release if your carrier allows, if it's okay, if your mommy says so. Anyway, 18 months of updates. We'll see how that goes. But yeah, you want to shoot for 2.2.
A few other things. It says AT&T will offer the Go Phone plan beginning September 18th with 240 voice minutes and unlimited texting for $25 per month. So if you got a phone that works with. And of course, there's things over in the rumor mill that still talk about exactly what's going to happen here with the upcoming iPhone, because some still believe there's going to be an iPhone 5, maybe also an iPhone 4S. And maybe that 4S will offer some prepaid options. So we'll have to see what comes of that. But Tim Cook did say himself back in February that Apple doesn't want its products to be just for the rich. So I guess we'll see what's going to happen here.
That's right. And in more Apple news, they have removed estimated shipping times from their online store. This apparently came about after the actual ship times of some iPhone 4 units were slipping. So usually you'd see ships in 24 hours, and then it was 1 to 3 days. And then it kept sort of going down from there. So what they've done now is you'll just see that a unit is in stock. They're not going to give you actual shipping estimates in the store.
Right. You might see things like 2 to 3 weeks if there's limited availability, but again, no specific. They're not going to tell you what day it's going to arrive.
So you can jump up and down and say, is it here yet? Is it here yet? Is it here yet? All you want. Not going to do you any good. If you are a developer for iDevices, you might find this site of use. It basically pulls together a catalog of iOS libraries and development tools and things like that. The site is called iOS Frameworks, and the idea is that there are a lot of things that are already built for you that you don't have to do from scratch. And if you pull from these things, you're going to save yourself a lot of time. Now, it's not clear how many of these tools actually incorporate accessibility.
Yeah, that is iOSFrameworks.com. So our three hardcore programmers that listen to the show, go and write some cool iOS apps.
Yes,
we'll test
do
them
that
out here on the podcast.
We want them.
You want to watch TV on your iPad? It looks like NBC, TNT, and TBS have full TV episodes via their iPad apps. And the question, of course, is, are they accessible? So you let us know that. But NBC.com and NBC Live are both free and available in the App Store. Now, TNT and the TBS apps require that you have cable. So I guess somehow you validate the apps that you do truly pay for cable service, so you only get it as an addendum to already paying for it through your local cable provider. I'm not sure quite how that authentication works, but
there's an authentication scheme that a lot of companies are starting to use now to make sure that you have either DirecTV, Dish, or one of many cable providers in order for you to be able to use the software. I did have an opportunity to play with the NBC app prior to our recording time. It's a little easier to use than our current Netflix, and just as not fun to use as current Netflix on iDevices. So you can search for shows, you can find shows, you can get information about shows, but when I was playing a clip, it wasn't really obvious to me on how I moved back in a page or how I stopped things or replayed things. So I tried to look up episodes of Chuck, and I had a real difficult time doing it. Now, with that said, it's a little better. Well, it's a lot better than Hulu Plus is at the moment that we record as well. So a lot of these apps really don't have a lot to offer accessibility-wise, and that's a shame because it would be really nice to be able to catch up on some of these things while out and about.
Well, good news in terms of TV and accessibility. A few TV studios have begun quietly adding closed captioned episodes of various shows to the iTunes store. It's not really clear when this actually started happening. It wasn't really publicized very widely, but it looks like only the current seasons of the shows that are being added have that closed captioning support. So they haven't gone back and retroactively added this to previous seasons yet. But this is cool to see. I'm hoping to see audio description for these videos as well.
Some of the networks include Fox, FX, CW, and ABC. So we shall see if, maybe that's where we need to advocate for some audio description as well. And it mentions a few particular shows that were first to show up here. I've never seen before Sons of Anarchy, yeah. New Girl, Switched at Birth, and Secret Circle, just to name a few. We've talked before about reading books from your local library, even audiobooks, from a service called Overdrive. And AppleVis tells us of an app for your iOS device, Overdrive Media Console, that gives access to audiobooks and some electronic text, apparently MP3s and EPUB books. But there are a few caveats. Certainly your public library has to be a member of this service. But it also mentions that some schools and college libraries are a member, so you certainly just want to ask to find out if it is available one way or another. And it says there are 15,000 libraries around the world that participate, offering best-selling and classic titles. And you can use Get Books to find local libraries near you. Books are borrowed, in most cases, just like if you went to the library, so you can check out a title. You have to have, of course, a valid library card, and you download directly, and each book has an expiration kind of period. but it lets you know kind of how much time you have yet to finish the book. And if you if the book's checked out, you submit your email address and you're emailed to kind of let you know that the book is available for retrieval. Ricky, is this something you played with?
I haven't played with it yet. I'm not sure that my local library supports OverDrive, and it's something I've been meaning to look into for a while, and this may just be the thing that gets me to do that. There's one thing that I don't know why I didn't realize this, but I always wondered why you had to check out a digital book. You know, it's digital. Why are you checking this out? It's not like somebody's holding it physically, but apparently the reason is that each library has to purchase the rights to the digital book that they want to check out. So if they've only purchased the digital rights to one copy, then obviously one person can have it at a time. And again, I don't know why I never thought about that, but that's how it works. And I'm kind of looking forward to checking out this app. You can even get ebooks on it, but the AppleVis entry stated that the tester wasn't able to test how accessible reading an ebook was. So we still don't know that yet.
But the app is free, so just contact your local or college library.
What do you got to lose?
What do we got to lose? Yeah. And kind of let us know. Maybe someone could do a product review, a demo. Now that we're weekly, we need more demos.
Bring on demos.
From the Mac Rumor Mill, I don't know that this is a new rumor. I've heard something about this maybe as long as 6 months ago, but supposedly someone from within Apple has leaked that Apple is allegedly,
I'm using that word, allegedly,
working on a native scanner app for iOS devices, which would allow users to use an iPhone, iPod Touch, or iPad camera to scan in documents, maybe business cards, and automatically import them into your contacts. I know that's already done on Android, so that could be a motivating factor to maybe get up to speed on offering something like that, but this one maybe let you import the scanned material into pages or contacts. And of course, scanning would, according to some documentation, require a better camera than is currently available on either the 3GS or iPhone 4. So we'll see if the iPhone 5 truly does offer a better camera or if anything comes into fruition on this one. But that'd be a rumor, folks.
And if it is Apple doing it, it would be interesting because Apple can get to the camera in ways that many third-party developers can't. So it would be interesting to see what Apple could do that would be different than some of the other applications that are out there that does that. And the reason why that is that Apple uses the phone with FaceTime. FaceTime is a part of the operating system, so there's certain things that Apple can get to that others can't. So if this is, again, rumor, if this is true, it could be very interesting.
Well, if you're one of the lucky few or not who still owns a PowerPC Mac, you're a bit out of luck, at least in terms of security, because Apple is now canceling security updates for those Macs. Previous security updates did support Leopard and even Tiger, but now the latest security updates are going to require at least 10.6 or 10.7. So again, if you have a PowerPC, you might want to think about trading that in for a shiny new Mac that's going to be a lot more secure and faster and shiny. Did I mention shiny? Yes.
What other software news? Of course, we mentioned this earlier out of turn, but ESET has released Nod32 antivirus and Nod32 Security Suite 5.0, and not as accessible as I would like, so my verdict is still out on it, but it's not looking good if this is one of your favorite security solutions. I mean, I hear the prompts, but I can't get to them. So let us know with your various screen reading technologies if it is working or failing you. Does it get one of those big number fail hashtags for you there?
Trying is the first step towards failure.
Radio failure.
Ouch. Yeah, not good. Well, if you have installed an antivirus program that it turns out that you hate, or more likely your machine has been shipped with some 30-day trial of something that's just horrid and you want to remove it, you might find this article useful. It's a list of uninstallers for common antivirus programs. They mentioned that a lot of times just going through the add remove programs process in Windows is not enough to get rid of these antivirus programs. So you actually want to look at this list of uninstallers for these programs so that they can completely be wiped from your system before you install whatever it is that you prefer.
And when we come back, we're going to tell you about how you can get free librarian assistance online. How cool is that? Something you just, information you just absolutely cannot find. A lot of other news from Google and just our cool stuff news all coming up for you on Podcast 77.
When I have an asthma attack, I feel scared. It's like tiny nails in the air poke my lungs.
I start to cough. Sometimes my parents have to take me to the hospital.
Today, one out of 13 children suffer from some form of asthma, accounting for nearly one-third of all emergency room visits.
I feel like I'm choking.
It's kind of like an elephant is on my chest.
A little whistle sound comes out when I breathe.
But while your child may suffer from asthma, asthma doesn't have to make your child suffer. There are simple ways you can prevent your child's next attack. To learn more, call 1-866-NO-ATTACKS. That's 1-866-662-8822. Log on to www.noattacks.org or call your doctor. Because even one attack is one too many.
I feel like a fish with no water.
Brought to you by the EPA, the Ad Council, and this station.
And you are listening to Serotalk Podcast 77 for September 20, 2011. If you need to speak with a librarian to find information blind and low vision persons can use a free service called InfoEyes at www.infoeyes.org. You can ask about anything, they say. And they use iVocalize software, I guess, for live interactive voice chat. But you can also email your question or schedule an appointment weekdays during business hours, I would guess. And they have links to participating libraries, so you can find out maybe a phone number for your local library. Because I did find a service like that here in Evansville where I can call an info desk and speak with the library to look up information. And as the mileage goes, some are more helpful than others.
The second annual Accessibility Summit is taking place on September 27th. You can attend this online. You're going to need to purchase your tickets, but this is chock full of accessibility goodness. You've got speakers like Jared Smith, John Folliott, the list goes on, and it's covering things like accessibility in HTML5, the inexactness of web accessibility, sort of talking about how while you can have guidelines and standards that you attempt to follow, that doesn't always answer everything that needs to be answered in terms of accessibility. So if you're interested in that, check out the link in the show notes and purchase your tickets for it.
Well, an EU-funded project, that's the European Union and not EU. But the EU-funded project, I always wanted to say that, is aiming to make self-service cash terminals in Spain and Germany more accessible for people with disabilities as well as senior citizens. As a new study shows, the EU is way behind the U.S. and Canada. So some new trials will begin in September in cash dispensers in Barcelona and in January 2012 in Paderborn, Germany, with 3,000 users who will test these machines over a three-year period. This will include some stuff I really haven't seen wide-scale in the U.S. yet, called NFC, and near-field communications that we've talked about, and some other wireless communications technologies. So we'll let you know of other talking cash dispensers in Europe as we find out about them, or if you know of things we don't, and that's very possible.
Oh, indeed it is.
Let us know at resources@serotalk.com, yeah.
Probable, in fact. Anyway, the JetBlue saga continues. The lawsuit is now being appealed after having been decided about 2 months ago. A judge ruled that no, JetBlue did not, because of state law, have to make its kiosks accessible to the blind and visually impaired. Basically, it is stated that JetBlue did everything that they needed to and that was required by the rulings from Department of Transportation. And obviously, there are several people very upset about this, and this is going to be appealed. It may take up to 3 years for this to finally be decided.
Yeah, I think there's also a lawsuit with United.
Yes.
We may be hearing more from that as well. Of course, if you want more information on this, you can go to Lainey Feingold's website, lflegal.com, where you can get email updates or follow her on Twitter, the tag of lflegal.
The federal courts have jacked up online access fees by quite a lot. They've gone from 8 to 10 cents per page. Now, this may not be such a big deal to the layman, but if you are a researcher, a reporter, any person who needs to be able to access these documents, legal documents online, is going to now have to pay 10 cents a page as opposed to 8 cents. And it turns out that the money which comes from this was being used to outfit courtrooms with additional technology, such as in one case, they basically had speakers in the benches in the courtroom. So if you're still sitting way in the back, you're not going to have a problem hearing the testimony and so on.
Yeah, monitors for jurors. This was an interesting story because I used to use this. It's called Pacer. I work with the Better Business Bureau where we want to research some rulings and so forth. So this is going to generate $100 million a year. They did use the term slush fund and yes, said that, you know, that you have 207 different websites instead of one centralized website. So this thing is very costly and really mismanaged in a lot of ways. And the argument states, and I kind of agree, that this data should be, the raw data should be put out there for Google and Internet Archive, archive.org, to build websites using this data so that we, the citizens, can actually learn about the laws that we have to abide with.
Exactly. So, and as it stands right now, each of these districts are creating their own sites. So there's no centralized management system for this stuff either.
Yeah, it does make it a challenge to look up information. This is one I'd heard about, but it's maybe more large scale than I thought. A new report on fair housing highlights from the Department of Housing and Urban Development, also known as HUD, about their efforts to end housing discrimination, states that there were more than 10,000 lawsuits filed in 2010 for fair housing discrimination, and complaints by persons claiming disability discrimination were actually about 48% of those. And to put it in perspective, that's compared with, say, 34% for racial discrimination or 15% for people who file disputes over family status. That's a big issue of what constitutes a family. People moving in and out, not related, not married, and so forth. But 48% are almost 5,000 complaints. So that's in 2010, and it said the previous 3 years were about on the same track. So I'd be curious to hear from you if you have ever or know of someone who has actually had to file a claim. Because while the Housing and Urban Development, that's a national program, it's administered in many different cities throughout the country. So a lot of folks have had difficulty either in acquiring houses, whether it be rental or purchases. So we'd like to hear from you. And of course, you can read the report or link over at SerialTalk.com. See if they really are making improvements and how this works.
Well, the president of Perkins School for the Blind, Stephen Rothstein, responded to a recent address to Congress that Obama made. In this address, Obama was talking about the 9.1% unemployment rate in the U.S. And of course, Rothstein responds with, hey, the blind community has about a 70% unemployment rate. And he goes on to say that there's going to be a statewide disability fair coming up on October 18th. That's in Watertown at the Perkins School for the Blind. So you can actually come to this job fair and get an idea of how blind folks and others with disabilities would function in several different types of jobs. Another thing that he suggests is that you give a critical internship to a person with a disability so that you can see firsthand what it's like to employ someone with a disability.
That all sounds good. We talked about this in the last podcast. I was concerned with this statement that says it is within our power to give everybody a shot to get work without spending a dime. How does that happen? I mean, AT costs money. I don't understand that. How are you going to not spend a dime? But I think that is cool. They do have a statewide job fair for the blind. I don't know if anyone other than Massachusetts is doing that. I'd like to hear from our listeners about any type of disability-based job fairs that take place throughout the country or in other countries outside of the U.S.
Well, if you've been looking for a Perkins Brailler, and we're talking about the old school Perkins Brailers, because we all know how Michael, at least, feels about the newer ones.
Useless piece of plastic.
You can get one of these refurbished for $200. The Lutheran Blind Mission in Missouri is doing this. So again, $200, can't beat that to get a refurbished and fully working Perkins Brailler. Good stuff.
Yeah, I don't know if you can do that online, but the website is blindmission.org, or you can call them. They're based in St. Louis with a toll-free number in the States at 888-215-2455. So be a geek like me and keep a Perkins on your desk. You never know when you might need it.
Speaking of Braille, Rosetta Translation announces that they're going to implement a Braille translation service. They're primarily known for providing interpreters and doing language translation. So, for example, English to Spanish and vice versa. They do a lot of this for the financial and the medical sectors. And now they've noticed a marked increase in the need for documents presented in Braille. So they said, hey, why not? Let's do this. Let's add this to our list of translation services.
Well, not only medical and financial, but also legal and technical. So since we have a lot of folks working in those industries, hopefully that will open up some Braille documentation for folks either practicing law or studying law and working in various technical spaces that need Braille.
Well, it's the point in the show where we pat ourselves on the back because we can. It's self-promotion. If you have listened to the first episode of End of Line, you'll be happy to know that you can now get it in iTunes as well. You can just search for EOL Show, all one word, or you can check out the link in the show notes for the subscription. And if you haven't listened to the first episode of EOL, now's a good time to do that, because it's good.
And in Google land, it looks like Google enhances accessibility to docs, sites, and calendar. Well, sort of, kind of.
Yeah.
That is, of course, if you use JAWS and are willing to use the Firefox as your web browser, or if you just happen to use the Chromebox screen reader, which is available in the Chrome operating system. They do allege, though, that other screen reading technologies will be supported in the future.
I don't know what they're doing to make that happen, though. We haven't communicated or been communicated with much by the team who is working on docs and calendar support and the like. But my concern is, again, defining accessibility by saying it's accessible if you use these particular tools. What if you're just married to Internet Explorer and you really like it? You don't want to use Firefox or Chrome with Chromebox. Then what? What if you don't like JAWS? You know, you may be able to use other screen readers with some support, but there's always a danger when specifically naming a group of tools and then calling the result of using those tools accessible.
Oh, yeah, this raises a lot of questions. We can clearly see that the days of having only one screen reader, using only one web browser are over, although some said it's always been that way. But, you know, when they talk about keyboard shortcuts, in this case, they're talking about those shortcuts being embedded in the browser. So you have to use a certain screen reader to take advantage of those to navigate to different parts. So, but this is a price, I suppose, of us going to cloud-based where everything is in the browser. So it's either going to mean that screen reader makers are going to have to spend a lot more time keeping up with the Joneses and supporting all the different browsers, or I don't know. It's going to be very curious to see how this plays out. But again, like you talked about before, even with the website accessibility, what constitutes accessibility?
A good mention here is to go back and listen to our conversation with Yahoo, in which your interview with Victor kind of touches on the same kinds of things. I think it's really interesting that there seems to be not just in Google land, but it seems to be in other places too.
Well, we told you a few months ago that the original Sony Walkman is dead.
Did.
However, get ready for the 21st century Walkman. This sounds like a really cool device. Touchscreen, Android Walkman. Yes, with the Japanese release date of December 10, 2011. Looks like you can get either 16 gig, 32 gigabyte, or 64 gigabyte capacity units, boasting a 1 gigahertz dual-core processor, 512 meg of RAM, Android version 2.3, a 4.3-inch screen, LCD, of course, mini HDMI and mini USB, Wi-Fi, BG and N, Bluetooth. The big question is this thing going to talk? But hopefully pretty likely, because it does run Android, and there's a GPS and gyroscope in here.
It's supposed to support the market. Yeah, so
right.
If it supports the market, there's a good possibility that this will have some ability to have some form of a screen reader possibly on it. And I can't explain why I want it. I just do.
Walkmans are cool.
Maybe there's going to be different units because it talks about the Z series. So it says the Z series can support the full Android market. So the battery claims 20 hours for music and 5 hours for video. All kinds of audio and video formats are supported with this device. I think it's going to be a definite competitor to things like the iPod.
The Zune.
What we aren't sure of just yet is the price. The Zune, yeah, piece of crap for us. But the price could be somewhere, and these are just guesstimates because it's not out yet, and of course the conversion rate between the yen and the U.S. dollar is always changing. But as of now, the 16 gig... The quote might be somewhere around $360 US, whereas the 64 might be somewhere up around $550. But we will certainly let you know about the new Walkman when it's available.
I am the Walkman, cuckoo-ca-choo.
Oh, yeah. Speaking of sound, Michael Robertson, the guy who created MP3.com and always at odds with the Recording Industry Association of America, has created DAR.FM. That's standing for Digital Audio Radio. It's a TiVo-like service and radio that allows you to record and download radio programs. You had Michael Robertson not only creating MP3.com, but remember Lindos? That came in went like the bomb. Yeah, but people using iOS and Android can store their recordings at mp3tunes.com. The service is free for the very first show, and basically, his revenue model is you pay to have between 2 and 10 shows, a fee of $39.95 per year, and that lets you store the shows on their servers. And he claims that DAR.FM, I want to call it DAR, but I don't want to confuse it too soon, but DAR.FM can record any show on the internet. But, of course, Clear Channel and CBS will certainly scrutinize and have objections to this, so I'm sure this will be challenged. Probably in the courts and who knows how else. So we'll see what happens with DAR.FM for those of you who like to record your own devices. I just played with an app the other day. Free Windows piece of software that lets you record any stream. Well, not any stream, but at least Shoutcast, Icecast. I didn't have luck with Windows Media. So apparently that's the key, is there's no one-size-fits-all technology.
If you've ever needed to have something translated in real time and you just can't make yourself understood by waving your arms around and doing all these weird gestures to get your point across, you might find the following app of interest. It's called Vocre, V-O-C-R-E. It is an app that will translate what you say and then speak it on the fly. So basically what you do is you say what it is that you want to translate, then you got to turn your phone sideways to look at the text that has been recognized. So you'll read the text and make sure that the app did in fact recognize what you were trying to say. And if that's what you want, you tell it to translate and it will speak that translation to another person. The first 10 translations you get are free, and after that it's 10 cents every time you want to translate something, although you can buy in bulk. So if this is something you're going to be using a lot, you can get some discounts for buying in bulk.
Well, the one thing that got my attention with this, and I don't know if other technologies do this, but the first thing you do is choose your gender as well as the gender of the person you're speaking with.
Yeah.
That makes a lot of sense to me, because certainly the frequency of our voices is very different.
Well, not only that, but there are languages which the context changes and the way that you conjugate various things changes based on who you're speaking to. So your address might be completely different if you're speaking to a woman as opposed to a man or whatever. And so if you define the gender of the person that you're speaking to and the gender that you are, then it can automatically make those necessary changes related to the language that it's speaking.
For those of you who like choices with voices, we found a list of free text-to-speech options. And these aren't so much for screen readers. There might be a few voices in there to play with, but really it's more for ways to convert documents into audio files. Many of these I haven't even heard of. So again, you can go check out this extensive list with a link over at SerialTalk.com. If you've ever had problems with choppy computer audio, maybe either your screen reader kind of breaks up, the voice does, or when you're recording audio, you have lag, or maybe your audio and video aren't synchronized, or you just can't hear certain types of audio files, we found a very interesting article talking about three fixes to cure your sound woes. Now, really good stuff here because it mentioned some things I hadn't even thought of. Like, first of all, when I upgraded to Windows 7, my surround sound quit working on my Creative Labs card. But again, like I said, audio and video being out of sync, or instead of getting surround sound, you get mono, or the sound volume is way too low. I see that a lot with video programming, watching movies online and so forth. So a lot of cool suggestions here. He recommends an app called Matrix Mixer, and you can download that. It also talks about Windows 7 codecs. These are add-on, I guess, files, so to speak, that enable you to play all the various audio and video files that are out there. And finally, he talks about looking into your Windows audio settings and making two changes. And I've seen these before, never really know what they do, the good or bad. He recommends going into your Windows audio settings and unchecking both of the checkboxes. The first one says allow applications to take exclusive control over this device, and the other says something to the effect of give exclusive mode to application priority. So let us know if these tips help you out. You can get the link over at serotalk.com, but it has been helpful for me to troubleshoot some problems, especially with surround sound. But I see complaints occasionally of people having choppy speech, and you get that sometimes with onboard sound cards as Windows is using processing power to do something else. So give that a play and see if that makes your screen reader or other audio issues disappear.
From sound cards to guide dogs, that makes a perfect transition, does it not? Those of you with guide dogs will probably agree with the following article, which talks about how guide dogs have to deal with more distractions than ever before. Guide dogs are trained to put up with a lot and deal with a lot, and they're trained to stay on task and stay focused despite a lot of other things going on in their environment. But there is more for them to deal with than ever before. For example, electric cars. If you're a handler and you can't hear an electric car, you tell your dog to go forward because you're ready to cross the street. That dog has to employ what's called intelligent disobedience, meaning that if the handler has asked for something that's going to put the dog and handler in jeopardy, so the dog sees the car, the dog will have to not go forward, and in some cases do a body block so that the handler can't step forward either. There are some other things, like the fact that pets are pretty much allowed in a lot of places now. You can see pets in coffee shops, and certainly if you go to somewhere like PetSmart, you know, everybody and their dog's there, literally. And a guide dog has to remain focused despite having other dogs that they want to go and sniff at and say hi to and so on. And then, of course, there's the public. And I suppose this has always been a concern, but they see these guide dogs that are really well-behaved and they look so pretty and well-groomed and stuff. And so the obvious thing to do is reach out and pet them. And a lot of people just don't ask. And a dog has to remain focused even when they're getting this attention that they aren't supposed to get. So I do believe that jobs for guide dogs they get harder as time goes by, and there are more distractions for them to put up with.
Yeah, they mentioned 10 new distractions. The one I never thought about was skateboarders. Is there something about the sound, or just the quick movement, or the fact that the boards and the people are going up in the air, or...
That and the speed of the thing, you know, a skateboard or a bike can kind of come out of nowhere, and you've got to have a split second reaction time to jump back from that. My guide dog actually had an interesting distraction, and you may be right about the sound of the skateboard, because we were in the mall and there was one of these small sort of toy helicopters that was flying around overhead. And he was very distracted by this because it was making an interesting kind of sound, and he saw it above him. And since he didn't know what it was, you know, it wasn't like a, ooh, I want to jump up and play with that thing. It was more like a, I don't know what this thing is going to do, so I'm going to watch it very closely. I'll kill it if I have to, but, you know, I don't know what it's going to do. So he wanted to keep us both safe, but... he couldn't look away from this helicopter thing.
Yeah, not knowing what it's going to do, if it's going to come down in your path.
Right. Is it going to come down? Is it, you know, is it going to be something you have to watch for? It's going to hit one of us in the head or what?
Have you guys seen more bicycle traffic? Because with the economy the way it's going, I've seen more bicycles, and I've seen that cause problems at convention and other places. And I'm a cane traveler, so I see it a lot, especially when I'm traveling in Austin or going from airports.
I haven't really. That doesn't mean it's not happening, though.
Well, we often get questions on SamNet and via email asking about how to watch or listen to sporting events online. And while you certainly can't get everything that you might find on your cable TV, or maybe you actually want to ditch your cable TV as long as you can get your favorite sports, we did find some cool resources. A great article at Lifehacker talks about how you can do this and gives many feeds. There are feeds for football, basketball, of course, baseball. You got MLVTV.com. You got hockey, U.S. Open, the Olympics, and just some very specific sites that try to come up with as many online video streams for sporting events as well as TV stations. There's sites called Stream to Watch, First Row Sports, Ustream, that's spelled with a U, Ustream Sports, Watch ESPN, something called Full Size. So a lot of resources. If you just want to go over to SarahTalk.com, and we'll give you a direct link to it, or go over and look at it, lifehacker.com.
Our last story is something that I've been wishing someone would do for a long, long time. And finally, it has been done. A site called Blind Gadget is posting described XKCD comics. So I can remember people talking about comic strips, or as my parents called it, the funny papers. And they would read these things and they would just start chuckling for no apparent reason. And then they would attempt to describe the comics. But for me, something always got lost in the translation. I'm not really sure why. But I was excited to see these comics being posted daily. You can get the link from the show notes. And they're basically very short, you know, 3 or 4 panel comics. And it describes what is being shown, say a stick figure or whatever, and the thought balloons or the captions under them and any actions that are taking place. So it's very, very cool. Check it out.
Yeah, a lot of sick humor about Amelia Earhart. You can check that out. Well, that's going to put the wraps on the news segment. Coming up, Mike Cabo gives us part 1 of 4 on the latest MacBook, that being the MacBook Air. And we'll find out, is it the right device for you, or would perhaps an iPad be better suited? But in the first segment, we'll find out all the little cool stuff about the MacBook Air and the options and making sense of all that, which hard drives to get and what processor and all that cool stuff. We want your suggestions for segments, because part of going weekly is to give you all the great news more quickly, but also more product reviews and software reviews and so forth. So let us know what you want to hear, or we welcome your, if you want to make a contribution, we'd love to have your voice on the Cyril Talk podcast. Resources at CyrilTalk.com via iReport on iBlink Radio for Android or iOS. Or, of course, there's still the good old Blab line, 866-997-2522.
Stay tuned for some thoughts on the MacBook Air, and we'll see you next week with the news. Thanks for listening.
Now speaking with Mike Calvo in our first of a four-part series, exposing our listeners to all the niceties and maybe gotchas of owning a MacBook. And Mike, you just acquired the MacBook Air. And you love the device,
yeah, right? Yeah, I do, actually. Sorry for the recording sound, Michael, if it sounds a little strange with my normal recording getup. I am actually at Guide Dog Training School. So if I sound a little strange to the listeners, that's exactly why. You may have a little more room ambience. But the cool thing about this device, Michael, is the MacBook Air. You know, for a long time, this device was looked at as really a laptop that people carried around that didn't do much with computers. It was kind of, it was very expensive. The earlier versions were very expensive. Its claim to fame was the laptop that could fit in a business envelope. And to that end, it's still like that. The shape of the device hasn't changed. It's very, very thin. It is actually as thin as an iPad. Which brings us to one of the things that we're going to talk about during this this next few weeks is, wow, are we going to use a MacBook Air or are we going to use an iPad? And that's how we're going to wind this thing up at the end of the day. We're going to do four different things in the next 4 weeks. Today, we're going to just talk about the MacBook Air, talk about a few different features of it and what I like about it and why you may want to get one. Next week, we're going to talk about various cases and solutions for carrying it around. The week after that, while the MacBook Air has a really nice battery that lasts about 4.5 hours on Windows and about 5 hours on the MacBook, I mean, on the Lion side, it still doesn't compare to the 10 hours you get on an iPad. And there's some other caveats as well. But so we're going to want to power this thing when we're on the go. And we're going to, you know, also look at, you know, how we're going to carry technology with us, you know, for extra storage and things like that. And in the fourth week, we're going to ask the question, well, what is it, iPad or MacBook Air? And of course, along the way, you're welcome to submit questions. If I say something that you don't understand in one of these little talks we're having about this device, or if I leave you with some questions, please do send us questions. And we will be sure to answer them here. So to that end, the first thing about this device that I really like, of course, that everybody likes, is the size of it. And as I said before, it is the only computer that can actually fit into a business envelope. And when I say that, I mean it, people. You can put this thing in a regular FedEx package. Not that you'd want to because it's not padded, but from the outside, you just can't tell what the heck it is. It's so thin. It's got to be, oh my gosh, about 1/2 inch thick maybe at one end. And what it does is it kind of tapers down so thin that you could probably literally sharpen the end of it and cut somebody with it. There's actually a YouTube video that's this guy cutting different vegetables and things with his MacBook Air, with the edge of his MacBook Air. I'll make sure we can get that in the notes because it's hilarious to watch, at least. I'm sure it's not too much for us to enjoy, but it is kind of a funky visual. The device is actually become quite powerful, and the prices come down. And I think that these are two important distinctions from earlier versions of the MacBook Air. If Apple was going to truly make this device the form factor that the world was going to be carrying, they needed to lower the price, they needed to make it stronger, make it more valuable for a consumer to carry around, and not so much just a bling thing that CEOs and executives carried that just wanted to have the latest and greatest toy, but really didn't do a lot of computing. The version that I have here is the 11.6 inch, and let's talk about first the latest 2011 version of the MacBook Air. They come in two different sizes. You've got the MacBook Air, which is the 13-inch, and the 11.6 inch. As a totally blind user, I just don't see the value in buying the more expensive one with the 13-inch. Now, you do get approximately 1/2 hour to 45 minutes more of battery life out of the larger device. again, it just didn't seem to be that important. When we talk about processors, they are equally on par. You can start as low as $999 for a 1.2 gigahertz processor with 2 gigs of RAM, with a 64 gig SSD. All of these MacBook Airs have SSDs. None of them have moving hard drives. So they're all solid state drives, very, very quiet. They boot incredibly fast. They boot into Windows pretty darn quick. And they boot into Lion. Oh gosh, it must take 10, 12 seconds to get into Lion. It takes about two times that, maybe two and a half times that, maybe 20 seconds or so, 25 seconds to get into Windows. But now, once you're in your operating system of choice, and I happen to have a dual boot on mine, so I'm not running VMware or anything. I'm running a boot camp installation, which allows me to run Windows in its native form and Lion in its native form in their own different operating environments and totally separate from one another. I can actually close the lid of my MacBook Air, and it will go to sleep, and I can open it up again, and within about 3 seconds, I can be not only back on my desktop, but it will also go ahead and connect to any known wireless network that's in the area. And that includes my 4G phone that it'll connect to and use that as a hotspot. So it is a very, very zippy reconnection process. The next thing that you'd want to know, of course, about this device is the audio from it. And the audio is actually very, very loud. When you look at what netbooks had to offer in the past and the speakers are very small on this device. In fact, the design for the speakers and the fan is very interesting. First of all, the fan, there is a fan in there, and you can hear it when the system does things like plays, heavy duty, processor intensive things like videos and, you know, high definition videos and things like that. The fan may kick in, and it is a fan. So it does kind of, get a little loud, but not annoyingly so. The cool thing is that along where the hinge is, you've got little speaker grills that are buried back there that also act as kind of a heat sink or air dispersing areas for the fan. And that's it. This is one solid piece of metal. It's the unibody design. It's made of aluminum. And it's very, very nice feeling in the hand. You can hold it in one hand and kind of feel around and type in the other if you want to. I don't suggest you do that because you may drop your MacBook Air. But once you you decide, okay, I'm going to get a MacBook Air, you decide I'm going to get the 11-inch. And well, then the next thing is you're going to deck it out, right? So the base configuration, as I said before, starts with $999. It is it's a 64 gig SSD with the 1.2 gigahertz processor and 2 gigs of RAM. Now, these things are all configurable, okay? And the first thing let's talk about is the processor. You can buy a number of these, at least three different versions that I saw, or you can kind of have it customized. The version I bought, I was not able to buy at the Apple store, and I'll explain why in a second because of the combination of things. But the hard drive, first of all, the processor goes from a 1.2 gigahertz processor, Intel processor, of course. Then the next step up is a 1.7 gigahertz i3 processor with 3 megabytes of L2 cache for caching, and then the 1.8 i7 Intel processor with 4 megabytes of L2 cache, and that is real important. That 1 megabyte of cache really does make the difference. These are all dual core processors. I really don't think that people would really want the entry-level one. I mean, if you're going to do even just web browsing and stuff, you are going to watch the occasional YouTube video, and I'm running the 1.8 gigahertz version myself, and if the fan turns on there while I'm running a YouTube video, I can't even imagine how soon it starts running on the 1.2 gigahertz. Luckily, the price difference is not that huge, and you'll see when I tell you what the whole thing costs. But so the $999 machine, out the window. I wouldn't do that. Let's start decking it out. So let's first look at the processor. We're going to bring the processor up to a 1.8 gigahertz processor, the i7. Now, the next thing that you've got to choose is your SSD. Now, when it comes to Apple, all SSDs are not created equal. You've got the 64 gig SSD and the 128 gig SSD, and I forget the brand, but they are the same brand, and they're very zippy. They're very quick. And there's not a huge price difference between the two. I'd say there's about a $60 price difference or so, $100 price difference maybe between the two. You can go up to a 128 gig. Now, if you're going to go up to, and they do offer a 256 gig, be warned. A, you're going to pay $300 more. You're going to decrease the speed. Apple doesn't say that you decrease the speed. They never say that at the store, but if you look around and you read benchmarks that have been done in the industry, the fact is that the SSD, the 256 gig SSD, is slower. It's got a slower transfer rate, and it's $300 more, man. I mean, that's a lot of money. I would strongly suggest you get the 128 and look at some of the peripherals that I use, that if you need to carry more than 128 gigs worth of stuff with you, you can use cloud services, you can use other things. I'll be telling you about an external hard drive that I use that's very, very handy and not bad on the wallet that will really do the trick. We're going to go with our 128 gigabyte SSD. And then the last thing, of course, is the memory. This thing maxes out at 4 gigs. And the versions you can get it at the Apple store, they'll sell you the 1.8 gigahertz processor. They'll sell you the 256 gigabyte SSD, and they'll sell you the 4 gigs of RAM, but that's not what we want. We want the 128 gigabyte SSD. That you're going to have to order from the online store. Quite honestly, it's just as quick. It'll be at your house within 3 or 4 days. They ship it directly to you from China. And that, the price difference, let's just get it in perspective. The version with the 256 gig SSD, the 4 gigabytes of RAM, and the 1.8 gigahertz processor is going to set you back $1,650. Okay, while on the other hand, if you drop $300 for that SSD and you bring it down to the 128, you're going to pay $1,350 for a machine that is pretty darn respectable. And I haven't even started going into other features that the machine has, such as it's got, let's see, I'm looking at it now, it's got one USB port on the right-hand side, which is nice. It's got another one on the left-hand side. It's got the earphone jack on the left-hand side. It's got a built-in microphone, a built-in camera. And then on the right-hand side, it's got the Thunderbolt jack. And the Thunderbolt jack is really cool because you're going to be able to hook up a bunch of different things like the new cinema display, and more peripherals as Thunderbolt becomes more and more popular are going to come in to play here. And I'm running Windows 7. I'm sure I can run Windows 8 once it's released next year. Like any other Mac, I don't expect to have to update this thing for a couple of years. My previous MacBook I had for 3 years and updated it. Simply because I wanted to get a smaller, thinner machine because I do a lot of demos of both our Mac and Windows software. I wasn't going to go with a straight PC. So I wanted to get this device. And quite candidly, it has not let me down in speed. It has not let me down in performance. I find it to be a very nice machine. It's very slim. It's got the connector for the electrical. It's got this cool magnetic connector, Michael. You have a MacBook, right?
Yes, it's a magnet, and that way, if it pulls off, you don't damage the cable or anything, or damage your machine.
Right, or if your guide dog just decides that he's going to get up from under the table real quick and hit the cable, which is hanging over the edge, it doesn't knock your machine onto the floor. For $1,350, Michael, this is a great machine. I really, really, really like it. I've had enough time to be carrying it around for 3-4 weeks. The battery life on it, 4.5 hours, doesn't sound like much. But in our current age, remember, folks, most people carry smartphones now. In our current age of smartphones and computers and iPods and all this other stuff, generally, we're not going to keep a laptop running for 4.5 hours on battery just straight. Now, that may be the case, But the power supply for this thing is so small that it will fit in a bag. And one of the solutions that we're going to talk about in the next 4 weeks is bags, because one of the things I did find is that bags, when it comes to the MacBook Air, at least for now, a lot of bags are fashion over function. And as blind folks who like to have our hands free, we want to definitely have function over fashion. But I think that you're going to find that the bags that we're going to be reviewing are both fashionable, functional. They are not economical. I will warn you right now, you know, Apple is not cheap. There is nothing cheap about Apple, and it's not cheaply made stuff either. $1,350 is a darn good price for this machine. I'm surprised that it is that that economical. I'm looking out there at these new, what are they called, Ultrabooks? That they're trying to put out that are kind of like these MacBook copies, but just running Windows, and they still have not been able to touch the Mac price point. They've kind of been able to match it by including, you know, things like plastic and things like that in the body, but nobody has come out with a device that is as good looking, as sexy, if you could call a computer sexy, as a MacBook Air, and as functional, as powerful. I think I really, really am enamored with this machine. I really don't have anything bad to say about it.
I guess one question we have is, how can a machine that thin really have a good quality responsive keyboard? Talk about that experience.
Well, the keyboard is very full. I don't miss anything about the keyboard compared to my old MacBook 13-inch. Now, I will say that when you're running Windows on the boot camp side, the keys do get changed around a little bit. So instead of having, for example, where you would have your control, your Windows key, and then your Alt key, in Windows on the MacBook Air on the Windows side, we have the function key, which is the FN key. We have a control key. Then we have the Alt key, and then we have the Windows key. And then on the right-hand side of the space bar, we have a Windows key, and then we have a right-hand Alt key. So there is a little getting used to when it comes to hitting keys that you're used to hitting. But, you know, it's funny. I've been doing it so long now that I actually go to a Windows machine, and I'm hitting the wrong key to bring up the Windows thing, and I have to remind myself, nope, it's one key over. But besides that, you can really book. I don't know how they've been able to do it, but they've been able to maintain the keyboard size pretty darn well. I mean, I feel very, very comfortable typing on this thing for a long time. For those of you that need to look at the keyboard, it is a backlit keyboard. So that's very helpful when you want to look down at your keys. Of course, that doesn't apply to me, but it's available and it's there.
And those are also things you can do to increase battery life. Turn off the backlit keyboard and reduce the brightness of the display.
You can, and that's very cool. You can actually set that up in the Windows Energy settings. As you can tell, I don't use Lion a lot. I'd welcome any comments from any MacBook Air users that use Lion. I use Lion pretty much to demonstrate our software. I find VoiceOver to be functional but not productive yet. I hope I didn't insult any of our listeners. I just haven't taken the plunge, if you will. I use System Access on the Windows side, and I'm real happy with it. And it's zippy. Now on the energy savings stuff, you can bring the screen all the way down. And if you leave it on its lowest setting and you decide, well, I just don't want it on at all, you just hold the function key down. And then you hit the F1 key a few times, and it'll just turn off the screen. People, hey, what are you doing? Your screen's dark. You know, but it will give you a little bit longer battery life. I don't know how long, because I've never really ran the screen at full tilt. But I have yet to run out of battery with this thing on the road. And I've spent hours at doctor's offices, and especially here with the guide dog, where it's hurry up and wait. Where you're sitting around waiting to take a walk with your guide dog and everything, you know, I've really been able to run it up and use it with Wi-Fi and everything, and I have not run out of battery with it.
Well, very nice. I think you've done a pretty good overview for our first of four segments. And of course, as you mentioned, folks can send your comments, resources at serotalk.com. You can use iReport to put in your 2 cents or ask a question. And maybe we can play some of those as well. That's, of course, on iBlink Radio for iOS and Android. And, of course, we have the infamous Blab line at 866-997-BLAB-2522.
Thank you, Michael. I'm really excited about this machine. I really think that as blind folks, we need to keep our eyes, if you will, on Apple. I think that this is a great device. You know, the bottom line is people say, well, why do you buy Apple? Well, there's a couple of reasons. A, the quality. I love the build quality, not only on this device, but on any Macintosh product I've purchased. I think that Apple's build quality is spectacular. It's superior to just about anything I've seen on the market. The insides of certain consumer electronics, okay, I can say there's higher megapixels and certain cameras and things like that in the market, but the beauty of Apple stuff is it just works, it's solid, it's a good investment, and the reality is that you can run Windows on a Mac, but you can't run Lion on a Windows PC. So, I'd rather get more by being able to run the two operating systems side by side so that when Lion becomes more productive, and I'm sure it will for me, and I'm not saying it's not productive for others, it's just for me and what I do in my life, it's not productive at this time. I'm sure when it does become more productive, I'll just be able to move right over to Lion, and when I do need to jump into Windows, I can do that as well. Go get one. They're really cool.
All right, join us next week for part 2 of 4 when we'll talk about cases and other cool accessories for your MacBook.
You've been listening to Serotalk. Visit us at www.serotalk.com. Send us an email at resources@serotalk.com. Send us an iReport with iBlink Radio, available in the Apple App Store and the Android market. Or leave a voicemail at 866-997-BLAB. That's 2522. We may read your email or play your voicemail in the next podcast. Join us next week as we explore all that life and the internet have to offer. Until then, may you have an accessible digital life. We'll